Next book. We're going to jump forward now to what is in our Tanakh, the last book in Tanakh. Right? In our Tanakh, anyways. Right? What? Meaning, it's not the order of Chazal in Bava Basra, but for this purpose, it doesn't matter. Well, you can look at a Gemara, right? It's totally not like this at all, right? Because it's partially more chronological, right? Rus goes where it should go, right? Things like that. Okay, anyways. Divrei HaYamim. So, Divrei HaYamim is the longest book chronologically in all of Tanakh by a landslide. Right? By a landslide.
Yeah, like chronologically. Just
like, amount of time that goes in. Correct, yes. It starts from Adam and goes to Hatzarat Koresh and the rebuilding of the second Beit HaMikdash. That is a long, long time, right? No other book comes close, right? Meaning, again, Bereshit is several thousand years long, right? Shemot is several hundred years long. Vayikra is 8 days long. Bamidbar is 39 years long. Dvarim is 30 days long. Yoshua is like 20-something years, right? Shoftim is 400-some-odd years. Malachim is 400-some-odd years. Divrei HaYamim is like 2,500 years, right? Or more, like 3,000 years. It's long. It's, again, from Adam HaRishon to the beginning of the Tkuva of the second Beit HaMikdash, okay? This is a very... this is a very long book. It is also a really, really strange book because Divrei HaYamim is in many ways a repeat of which two books? Shmuel and Melachim. Right? It is a retelling of the stories of Shmuel and Melachim. The Abarbanel opens up his description of this book and just says, "What is this thing?" Right, just what am I looking at? Why is this here? Why does this exist? Right, like you read Divrei HaYamim, you have one of two reactions. Either I've heard this before, or I thought I heard this before. Why are you telling me a different story that I thought I heard before? Right, those are the only two reactions you ever have. Okay, and sometimes it's really quite jarring. Like, to take the first example that when I took Divrei HaYamim in YU with Professor Sean Zelig Astor, who's a professor now at Bar-Ilan, he pointed out that if you follow the beginning of Divrei HaYamim, just to show you how weird this is, right? Divrei HaYamim tells you the history of the world starting with Adam, right? Literally, the first pasuk is Adam. The first word is Adam. Right? Adam, Sheit, Enosh. Kenan, Mahalalel, Yered, right? It's a repeat of Bereshit, okay? Then it just goes on, Perek Bet, Perek Gimel, Perek Dalet, Perek Hey, Perek Vav, Perek Zion, it just names. Perek Chet, Perek Tet, right? It keeps going on. What? No. It took Bruria 3 years. You think I'm going to do it in one night? Anyways, so...
Our minds couldn't handle it.
So remember, this is a history of the world. Okay?
That's a movie. Sorry.
Thank you. It's a history of the world. If I was writing a history of the world or a history of the Jewish people, name me an event that you might think should show up there.
Torah.
Yeah, Matan Torah, Yitzhak Mitzrayim. You know, we're recording the history of the world. It's just not. Perek Tet picks up. These are the genealogies. Oh, and Yehuda went into exile. That's it. Right? Like, here's all the genealogies, and Yehuda went to Bavel. Right? Like, it's a very strange book. Right? Like, Yitzir Mitzrayim, Matan Torah. You know, we're listing the history of the world, and those things just aren't mentioned. They just didn't happen. Right? Like, just it's just not important. Right? You get, like, descriptions of, like, the Plishtim attacking Yisrael, and then Pasuk Yud Aleph is already, like, Vaykaptu Kol Yisrael David Chevrona. And everyone came to David and Hebron, right? Like, so what exactly is this book? So the way Professor Astor got us to think about this book was he gave us an article called, I think, What is History? By Edward Carr, if I remember correctly, though it's been a decade since I looked at this. But he's a historiographer. Now, what is historiography?
The study of history, but not the history.
Correct. The study of the study of history. Yeah. Correct. It's the study of the study of history. Right? And Edward Carr makes the point that people think that history is a factual study. It's not. Right? No, it can't be. Why? So his example is, let's say, if I ask you, write a history of, write down every relevant fact that's going to happen to you today, right? So most of you would not bother writing down, like, you know, and I didn't have eggs this morning, because McDonald's didn't have eggs this morning, so I had, you know, whatever, I had a peanut butter sandwich or whatever, and then, you know, and then I went to the bathroom, and then I, you know, you might say, I went to shear, you might, right? I don't know what you would say. Okay, because you would legitimately say that what Zev ate for breakfast, as much as we love Zev, is not history worthy. Okay?
I don't know what Zev eats for breakfast.
But what Charlie, anyways. But he says, but what happens if you are, a historian of food? And you are writing a study of the eating habits of yeshiva, of American yeshiva students in their Shana Aleph. Suddenly, the only thing that matters.
It's also more important than Charlie, because he's a true Shana Aleph. Charlie's a fake Shana Aleph.
There you go. Right? So then, all that matters is what you ate for breakfast. Right? Which means, right? So his point, what's Carr's point? Carr's point is, look, even when facts are objective, right? Even assuming you have right, the right facts, what facts are important is always subjective to what story you are trying to tell. Right? 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 If you're trying to tell the study of what do Shana Aleph guys eat for breakfast, then in a Hanami, the only thing that matters is what did you guys eat? Right? If you're telling the story of, you know, educational theories in Shana Aleph programs, then the only thing that will matter will be shir or the schedule or something like that. Right, the guest speakers, I don't know, right? If you're writing the history of the, you know, exercise habits, then all that matters is how often Chaim goes to the gym, right? Like, it's...
I'm not the only one to work that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Chaim is the only one that matters, okay?
Let's talk about how
you do that. Now, therefore, historiography is like the new in thing. People really like historiography, and sort of part of that has spilled over in Tanakh study, that suddenly in the last, like, whatever, people really like Divrei Hayamim. Because Divrei Hayamim is, if you want to understand it, is a historiographical, right, a consciously historiographical work. Meaning, it is a retelling, right, it is a retelling of Shmuel and Milachim, but not simply to record details, but to tell a particular angle on the story. Okay? And therefore, if you want to understand Divrei Hayamim, which again, covers, even though it does technically cover from the beginning of the world until Hatzarat Koresh, primarily it focuses on the events of the Davidic dynasty, as recorded in Shmuel and Melachim, right? That's primarily the case, and returns with Hatzarat Koresh. Okay, so why would it do that? Yeah, Mati.
Yeah. Did the Barmel answer what the Ram was doing?
Oh yeah, but we'll get to that. But before we get to that, let's see if we can figure it out. I will turn to Zev for a moment.
Right,
Zev.
Question: just what unique angle is Divrei Yama trying to tell?
What?
So
the first point is that to understand Divrei Hayamim, it is a historiographical work. Then the question is, okay, well, what is it?
A fancy word, but it just has one thing it's trying to get across.
Well, not one. It's a few things it's trying to get across, but yes. Meaning,
one category of things it's trying to get across.
And therefore, certain details get played up, and certain details get played down, because it's telling a different story. Right? I mean, not... Right? Okay. What is, assuming this is written, now when is it written? When is the Divrei Hayamim written?
At least at the end of...
So according to Chazal, it's written by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, because it's written, obviously, in the time of... Right? Shivat Zion. Right? Meaning, it is a book which is written at the time of Shivat Zion, but records mostly events that take place during the period of the kings. Right? What? What did you say? Nothing. Right, but it takes place in time of Shivat Zion. Good, Zev. Since we're studying Shivat Zion in the book of Ezra, right?
Sure.
What story exactly, what, right? What is it going to want to tell? Right? What do we need to explain right now?
How did Galut happen?
No, it's not Galut. We're in the time of Shivat Zion. Right? What is everybody trying to do at this point? What is everyone trying to do? We've just been introduced to Ezra. So what is Ezra trying to do? Or Haggai. What are they all doing? And they're not just telling them, inspiring them. Yes, right? They need inspiration, right? These people are the people who are coming back in Shivat Zion are not exactly the high class of society, right? Meaning they are, you know, Mamzerim, Suffolk Mamzerim. There's some non-Mamzerim there, but like, literally, when the Gemara lists the Asar Yuchs and Alumi Bavel, among those are Mamzerim, Givonim, Suffolk Mamzerim, right? We call Shduktim and Asufim and all those, right? Meaning, these are not, it's a motley crew that makes it back, right? And it's quite hard. Because we have numbers in Ezra of exactly how many people came.
No, I don't know how much percentage of the were Mamzerim and Shduktim.
Oh, because the Gemara, because Ezra says so. These, we have numbers of every single group.
Oh.
It's not like, this is not like pretend, like we know exactly.
I don't know.
Of the 42 some odd thousand people that come back, we can account, the Pesukim account for 29,000 of them. Right? And they say, this many from this Shevet, this many from this family, this, da, 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 these are the Givonim, these are, like we know, this is not a guessing game, it's not a Midrash, it's just getting through the details in Ezra, which I know you all know Baal Peh. Right? Oh, as I open up to an article called...
Do you know Baal Peh?
No.
Okay, so why did we...
I've read it.
Well, why don't we get the eye roll for not knowing about Baal Peh?
He's lying. It was about Peh. He's humble.
Wait, you can't reset it to not Baal Peh, I
thought.
Okay.
Okay.
So let me just read you a translation of the Hakdama of the Abarbanel, okay? So here's the Abarbanel's Hakdama. These are doubts pertaining to this formidable question, but in searching for its solutions, I remain alone, and nobody joins me in this endeavor, right? The Abarbanel woke up and said, not only do I not know what this book is, no one seems to have cared until me. Like, I just didn't care. I feel alone. Now, it's sort of funny because the way he writes his books is crazy. You know how the Abarbanel wrote his Sfarim? It's like, it's crazy. Like, certain people, like, you imagine, they worked for, like, their whole life. And have you ever seen the Abarbanel? It's long. It wasn't like he wrote all the time. He had creative spurts, and he just wrote. So, like, according to his own records, like, he wrote his parish in Yoshua and Shoftim, like, in 2 weeks each. And then, like, in Shmuel, in, like, 4 weeks. And all, like, consecutive. Like, he had, like, a creative summer. He just wrote his parish in Yoshua, Shoftim, Shmuel, and Malachim or something. It's, like, it's crazy. Right? Absolutely crazy. So he, at some point, comes to Divrei Yamim. And he says, well, no one seems to have done this. I have not found any discussion, great nor small, in the words of our sages of blessed memory, not the sages of the Talmud, nor the later commentaries. God has added to my grief, in that there is no commentary on Chronicles in this land, with the exception of the few glosses of Radak of blessed memory, and those comments are negligible in their brevity, and he did not address this issue at all. Additionally, the Jews do not study Chronicles in their academies, meaning no one cares, no one learns it, no one nothing. I confess, and then in a wonderful line that should make all of you feel better, and he says, I confess my own sins today. I have not studied it nor explored its issues until now. Meaning, this is also, he's like admitting, he's like, it's not like, I've read this before, never wrote a parish. Like, no, I've never really opened this book until right now, as I stand before you, and I write it. Okay. Good. Okay, so, do you want me to give away the end and then give examples, or should I give you an example first? Which do you want?
Give an example first.
If you give us an example, can we guess the end?
Okay, fine. So I'll take the Ray Angel has two very nice articles here where he just sets up the problems very, very clearly. So let me give you an example, okay? Let us take the portrayal of. Okay, do you want Achaz and Chizkio? Achaz and Chizkio? Okay, let's do Achaz and Chizkio, okay? What? So Achaz, Okay, do you want me to read you the original or just follow through and read the English to help you guys? Fine, okay. Achaz. What? This is Malachim Bet, Perek, Tet Zion, Bet through Dalet. This is the version in... Okay, let's make a chart here, okay? This is how we're going to do it, okay? Let's start with Achaz, okay? And what we're going to do is we're going to read through Achaz as described, a few key moments in Achaz's life as described in Malachim, right? And in Divrei Hayamim, okay? So, okay, point one. This is Malachim Bet Perek Tet Zion. So here we find out that he did not do what was pleasing to the Lord his God as his ancestor David had done, but follows the ways of the kings of Israel. He even consigned his son to the fire, meaning Vigamet Beno Ha'avir Ba'esh, right? You know, Molech, you know, or something like that. Not good. In the abhorrent fashion of the nations which the Lord had dispossessed before the Israelites. He sacrificed and made offering at the shrines on the hills and under every leafy tree. So, is he negative?
Yes.
Oh yeah, he's negative. Okay. But how negative?
Pretty.
I mean, we don't fully know. It's described in three psukim, right?
But all it says
meaning,
is that he worshipped idols. That's
okay, one second. So, he is... Sir, okay, so let's be clear. So, look. Okay, so let's take one point. He is, right? What did he do to his son?
He burned
it. We don't know that. What did he do?
He gave him the fire.
He passed him through
good.
The fire.
He was... Ha'avir, right? He passed him through.
He used his son for
the Lord. Yes, and he passed him through. But did he kill him? We don't know, right? It is the point is we don't know. Okay. Okay. Now, in Divrei Hayamim, on the other hand, look at Divrei Hayamim Bet, right? Pasuk Chav Chet. Again, Pasuk Bet through Dalet. This time, he vayaver et banav ba'esh. He burnt his sons in fire. So, ha'avir, which is, you know, a question mark. In Divrei Hayamim, he burns his sons alive. Right?
A little worse now.
Right?
I don't know.
Okay?
He's not a worse, but went to a murder. Both
are bad. Okay, good.
Yo,
that's difference number one. Okay? Difference number two is what happens in the war between what he calls the Syro-Ephraimite War. But okay? So this is in Malachim Bet Perek Tet Zion. Wait, you know, I'm going to open up. Perek Bet. Perek Bet, Pasuk Tet Zion. Sorry, Malachim Bet. I'm sorry. Malachim Bet. Perek Tet Zion, Pasuk Hey. So you hear. So Az Yale Ritzin Melcharam Pekach Benrim Aliyo Melch Yisrael Yerushalayim Melchama Veitzur Alachaz Velechul Ilachem. So he has a war, right? King Ritzin of Aram and Pekach Benrim Aliyo, right? They fight against Yerushalayim, right? Ba'edahi Yishiv Ritzin Melcharam Eilat LaAram Va'inashal Yudim Eilat Va'adomim Bo Eilat Ve'Yishusham Ariyom Azem. Okay. So, what happens? So there's this war against Aram, and what is his reaction? So Achaz sends messengers, Vayishlach Achaz Malachim al Tiglat Paleser Melech Ashur, Lemor Avdecha Uveni Ani. Right, sorry, Uvencha Ani. He says to Tiglat Paleser, the king of Ashur. Right? So what's happening? He's being attacked by Aram and Yisrael. Okay? Remember, Yehuda fighting Yisrael. So he is fought by Aram and Yisrael. So what does he do? He says, what's the best way of me saving myself? Is by calling in, right? The superpower of the day, right? This is like, you know, Israel is in a fight with Lebanon, so they ask for help from America.
Yeah.
Right? Right? So he's in a fight with Aram and Yehuda, sorry, Israel, so he asks for help from?
Ashur.
Ashur is the world power at the time. As we know, Ashur, the kings of Ashur viewed themselves as? What did they call themselves? The kings of Ashur referred to themselves as?
The lions.
The kings of the world.
Oh, well, that's pretty good.
That's good. Right? Right? I mentioned this to Zev, that when I went to the British Museum in February, they're having, I think they still are, when you go back, you should go, they're having an exhibit on ancient Assyria, which is called I Am Ashurbanipal, King of the World. Right? That is what it is called. Okay? Like, this is how they viewed themselves. What? It was quite. They made a big deal of it, even though all the really good stuff is in the free section, and that's like 17 pounds or something. So maybe you don't want to go, but whatever. But the point is, just looking at the title, "I am Ashurbanipal, King of the World," right? You understand that Assyria were high on themselves, okay? So
to be fair, every
yeah, but the Assyrians were pretty darn bad. Okay, anyways, so he says to Assyria, he says, "Listen. I am your son, I am your servant, please save me from Aram and Yisrael." And then in Pasuk Chet, he gives him the gold and silver that are in the Beit HaMikdash, and the gold and silver in his treasuries, and the king of Ashur did it. Okay? So what does he do in this one? So the two is the war, right? What does he do? Is he viewed as bad? I don't know. Like, giving the gold of the Beit HaMikdash, Chizkiyahu does it also. Right? Like, it's not like a... Right? Like, he bribes...
Doesn't Chizkiyahu, like, give the doors to the Beit HaMikdash?
Yeah, like, he gives the gold off the Beit HaMikdash, right? He bribes Ashur. It's, you know... Okay, I'm just reading to you. Okay? And now Assad does this. Right, Assad's a good king. Okay, guys. Now... How about in Divrei Hayamim?
He burned down the Beis HaMikdash.
So, in Divrei Hayamim, so first of all, in Divrei Hayamim, we find out that there is, they inflict massive devastation on Yehuda, right? As opposed to in Melachim, where they don't defeat him, okay? Right, so the first one is that, the second point is that in Melachim, right, they... they can't defeat Achaz, right? They don't defeat him, right? Here, they inflict massive casualties, okay?
This will lose, right?
What?
This will lose.
Yes, but first they inflict tremendous casualties, which leads to a bit of a problem. Now, in addition, right, what you get is that at that time, King Achaz sent the king of Assyria for help. Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, marched against him and gave him trouble instead of supporting him. Now, this is a bit of a difference. Right? He asks Ashur for help, and in the version in Divrei Hayamim, he doesn't get it. Right? Right? He asks for help, right? And, you know... And instead of this being a successful bribe, he tries to bribe them and it doesn't work. Right? That's a
difference
as things go. Okay? The third one, okay, is how it is described. Achaz takes on some of the Avodah Zarah of Ashur, but here's how it's described, okay? In Melachim, you get, this is Melachim Bet, Perek Tet Zayin, Pasuk Yud, that when King Achaz went to Damascus to greet King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria, he saw the altar in Damascus. King Achaz sent the priest Uriah a sketch of the altar and a detailed plan of its construction. The priest Uriah did just as King Achaz had instructed him from Damascus. The priest Uriah built the altar before King Achaz returned from Damascus. King Achaz commanded the priest Uriah, "On the great altar you shall offer the morning burnt offerings and the evening meal offerings and the king's burnt offerings and his meal offering and the burnt offerings of the people of the land, their meal offerings and their libations. And against it you shall dash the blood of all the burnt offerings and all the blood of the sacrifices, and I will decide about the bronze altar. And Uriah did as King Ahaz commanded. So, what does he do? He copies the Mizbeach of Aram. Okay? Which is bad, right? But not so bad because, first of all, Uriah, who's known as a righteous Kohen, goes along with it. Which means that it's kaha kaha. Correct. The second is that it seems to be that he's imitating the altar, but using it for God. Right? So, you have, right? The altar is for God.
It's like the Bummos guy.
Correct. It's like a Bummos.
He may be a third thing that he's making us a third.
Yeah, but okay, so it's bad, but not like, it's not bad enough that even Uriah goes along with it. Okay? In Divrei HaYamim, on the other hand,
Perik what?
In Divrei HaYamim Bet, Perik Chav Chet.
Destroy the other two.
1 second. Divrei HaYamim Bet.
Built an altar to
Baal
worship. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Very good. In Pasuk Chav Bet, here's how it's described. Uve'ed Hatzer Lo, when he had trouble, Vayosef Lim'ol Bahashem, Hu HaMelech Achaz. He continued to rebel against God. Vayizbach Lelohei Darmesek HaMakimbo. And he served the gods of Damesek, who were striking him down. Vayomer Ki Elohei Malchei Arame Mazrim Otam Lohem. And his logic was, well, Aram is successful, their gods must be powerful. Let me bring them, maybe they'll help me.
Oh, wow.
So,
you
know, this is...
So in short, he's retarded.
Yeah, so this is pretty bad, right? Okay, the fourth one, okay, last one here for Ahaz, is that in Malachim, because he's worshipping the Assyrians, he has to remove a lot of the gold and things from the Beit HaMikdash, and give it to Assyria. Okay, which we said is a bit ambiguous. However, in Divrei HaYamim, the last pasuk is, and after he did that, okay, so here is he takes gold of the Beit HaMikdash, okay? Yes. And in Melachim, he closes the Beit HaMikdash.
Oh, man. Oh.
Right?
Oh, sure.
And promotes idolatry.
Jesus.
Ahaz.
Oh,
same
okay.
story. So, here we go. Okay? In Melachim, he passes his children through fire. We don't know if he kills them. In Divrei HaYamim, he burns them alive. In Melachim, he isn't defeated, and he bribes Ashur successfully. In Divrei HaYamim, he asks for help and is rejected, and loses to Yisrael. In Malachim, he builds him his bath, which might be a bummer for God. In Divrei HaYamim, it's clear that it's for Avodah Zarah. And in Malachim, he takes the gold of the Beit HaMikdash. In Divrei HaYamim, he closes the Beit HaMikdash and actively promotes Avodah Zarah.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right.
That's Ahaz. Now, Chizkiyahu, very quickly. Okay, very quickly. Chizkiyahu.
Kind of interpretation
of the stories.
What?
Yeah. Okay, good. So, Chizkiyahu. Now, Chizkiyahu is good in both books.
But he's even
he is. Not however, in Chizkiyahu,
he's even better.
He's a Groysa Tzaddik, but he mostly loses.
Oh.
Right? Yerushalayim, he gets saved. But as I mentioned, in the rest of Yehuda,
right, left barren.
Right?
Destroyed.
Right? The Psukim emphasize a lot about the destruction of Yehuda.
Right.
But it's not presented as a punishment. It's just a reality. Meaning, Chizkiyahu is suffering because of Ahaz. Right, so it just happens, right? Like, this is just the political situation they're in. Malachim tells it matter-of-factly. Chizkiyahu is a tzaddik, but he still loses militarily, right? Yes, he has a miracle at Yerushalayim, but he doesn't in the rest of Yisrael. Right, in the rest of Yehuda. Okay? Fine. In Malachim, he depends on military assistance, right? He asks for military assistance there's an implication in Malachim that he had an alliance with Mitzrayim. Uh-huh. Right? Because Rav Shakeh, the general of Assyria, taunts him and says, why are you relying on...
Wait, this is Malachim or Devarim?
In Malachim. Yep. Right? In Malachim. However, in Chizkiyahu, right, he is the unparalleled tzaddik. He's not just a tzaddik, but it goes on for three full prakim about how much of a tzaddik he was, and that massive description of how he brings all of Klal Yisrael, including Israel, to the Beit HaMikdash. That's all in Devarim Yamim. It does not appear in Malachim once. Right? In Malachim, it just says, like, Chizkiyahu was great, and he made a big spiritual reform. In Divrei Hayamim, it spends three prakim telling us just how big of a tzaddik Chizkiyahu was. And it barely talks about the Assyrian devastation. It doesn't deny it happens, but, you know, it just says, after these faithful deeds, King Sennacherib of Assyria invaded Yehuda and camped against his fortified towns with the aim of taking them over. That's all you hear. It happens to be he succeeded, but you don't hear about that in Divrei Hayamim, right? In Divrei Hayamim, you don't hear that. Okay? Good. So now taking all this together, right? What is the point of Divrei Hayamim?
Emphasize character traits.
So there's two main messages that appear in Divrei Hayamim. Over and over again, okay? One is that Divrei Hayamim is trying to bolster Malchut Yehuda. Right? And therefore, Chizkiyahu, who is an ideal leader of Yehuda, what do? Yes, you spend a lot of time talking about how good he was. Right? In Malachim is just a historical recounting of what happened. Divrei Hayamim, we want to remind people as they're returning to Shivat Zion and rebuilding Malchut Yehuda. Remember, there's no longer Malchut Yisrael. Right? There's only Malchut Yehuda. They're returning to the area of Malchut Yehuda. What do you want to convince them of? How great Malchut Yehuda was. Right? We can rebuild the Beit HaMikdash. We can rebuild that which is identified with Yehuda. So what are you going to do? There was once a man named Chizkiyahu, and he was awesome. Let me tell you how awesome he was. Right? He built up the Beit HaMikdash, and he got Yehuda and Yisrael to come back to the Beit HaMikdash. Right? That's not important in Malachim. That's really important in Divrei Hayamim when you want to convince everybody to participate in building the Beit HaMikdash. Right? Which no one seems to want to do. Allah. Ezra, Nehemiah, Haggai, Zechariah, right? No one seems to care, right? You want to bolster people and say Yehuda is awesome. We all have a portion in it. So Chizkiyahu, right? Yay, Chizkiyahu, right? That's one point, okay? That's one of the goals. Another point is that Divrei Hayamim is essentially a long Musar Shmuz. Okay, in Musar Shmuzing, right, we want to emphasize simple spiritual messages, not nuance, right? And therefore, one of the fundamental messages, Charlie, of the Torah is that if you do something bad, what happens to you?
Get
punished. And if you do something good?
Get rewarded.
Good. Therefore, in Divrei Hayamim, if you're trying to convince people that good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people, do you really want to tell them that Chizkiyahu saved Yerushalayim, but all of the rest of Yehuda fell? You want to downplay, right? You can't deny that it happened, but you want to downplay the extent to which, you know, Chizkiyahu suffered, because you want people to say, oh, if I do good things will happen to me. Right? On the flip side, what do you want to say about Ahaz, who was evil?
That it didn't work.
Right? Now, yeah, you know, in both cases, like, he sort of lost something, he didn't fully, right? Without trying to be me out of the steer totally, right? Here, Ahaz is evil. Does he win wars? Does asking for help help him? No, he gets devastated. And Malachim, does it help him?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? It sort of does help him. Right? So point two is that the Divrei Hayamim is trying to convince people good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. Malachim is a historical record, which is totally fine with expressing nuance. Meaning expressing the fact, right? Malachim is much more political. Devarim is theological. So in Malachim, the reality is that even though good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people, sometimes if your father and your son are evil, then bad things happen to you too because you're still paying the political price, right, of mistakes that your father made. And therefore, if Ahaz was Chizkiyahu's father, then, you know, Chizkiyahu is still suffering. In Divrei HaYamim, right, it's a theologically oriented book, we want to, you know, downplay things like that. Not because they're untrue, but because, right, the same reason that when kids are kids, right, you tell them good thing, do good things and good things will happen to you. We all know that's not always true. But we do believe that at some deep level,
it should be,
and that's the message we all need to hear. Divrei HaYamim is much more theological, and therefore, what does it do? It, first of all, builds up how much Ahaz is punished, and also presents him in the worst possible light.
Yeah.
Right? Meaning, he's really bad, so really bad things happen to him. Chizkiyahu is good, really good, and therefore we downplay the bad things that happen to him and play up the good things that happen to him and the good things that he does.
That's almost like a lie about like a thing.
It's not lying. Meaning,
asking for help. Only asking for help.
Yeah, this one is the hardest one. This one is the one that the Mefarshim want to deal with. Right? This, it could be that he burned his sons, right? In Malachi, it's just that it uses an ambiguous language, so you don't know, right?
There's a much simpler solution than that. Come on, work chips in there.
No.
Smart program. Savage. And thank you so much.
Ephraim. You can solve it. My point is that Hevir is not, right? Hevir is ambiguous, right? In a way that Vayisrof is not, right? It just isn't to the point. Haraya.
It's going to blow your mind. Blow your mind.
No. Haraya, right?
Now I want to see what he's going to say.
No, you don't.
No, he's just going to. Are you just going to switch it?
Yeah. Dang.
You're not going to blow my mind. I also am capable of knowing that Hevir can be switched to Hevir. Yes. Thank you. Which would mean burn. But the point is that the Mefarshim actually have a machlokes about whether he burned him or not in Malachim. Right? But the point is that it's ambiguous in Malachim. Even if he actually burned them, Malachim purposely used the word that is ambiguous. Right? The third thing that's important is that alliances with foreign kings are really bad in Divrei HaYamim. They're not in Malachim. Because sometimes alliances are good. But at the time of Shivat Zion, right, we don't like this, right? We want the Jews to be independent, right? And the Nevi'im have a very negative opinion of alliances, which is true also later in the Nevi'im, in the period of Malachim. But in most of Malachim, alliances are fine. And therefore, in Malachim, we are happy talking about the fact that Chizkiyahu had alliances, right, with Egypt possibly, in Malach and Divrei HaYamim. We don't want to talk about it too much, right? Basically, what it comes down to, now just to summarize, is that Divrei HaYamim is a theological, historiographical work, meaning it is retelling the story with several goals in mind. One is playing up Mussar, right? Bad things happen to bad people, good things happen to good people. And therefore, we play up how bad people were, and we play up their punishment, and downplay the good things that happened to them. And good people, we talk about how good they are in a lot more detail, and downplay the bad things that happened to them. Malachim is okay with nuance, right? Now, why is that true, by the way? Why do you think that's true? Why is that a legitimate move? Why is that legitimate? Right? Okay, you guys just heard Professor Berman just a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, because of the whole...
Because in the ancient world, you tell stories differently based on the stage of life.
Right.
In the time of Melachim, right, you're telling this right after Chorban HaBayit, right? And some of it while you're going through it. While you're going through it, people have nuance, right? People are now suffering in the Chorban. They are aware of the fact that bad things have happened and that they're facing the consequences, and you're telling them the story of how it happened. By Shivat Zion, all of this is, there are no kings anymore, right? You're just trying to inspire them to do the right thing because these are people who are weak religiously, and you're trying to get them right, into the notion of rebuilding what used to be Malchut Yehuda, right? And therefore, right, you're telling them a story that they need to hear right now,
right?
You're telling them the angle that they need to hear. The way that our angel puts it is that it tells a longer view of history. Right? And this is how he writes it. Right? The destruction of the temple and exile form the climax of the Book of Kings. Right? Their decree was sealed during the notorious reign of Menashe. Meaning, the end of Melachim is the Churban HaBayit. And from the Churban HaBayit, it's important to what? Explain the ups and downs that actually led to Churban HaBayit. But by the time you get to Divrei Hayamim, most of the bad has been undone. They're on the process of rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash, meaning they don't need to know how we got here. Now they need to be inspired to rebuild, right? So now they need a longer, right, view of history with more sort of theological truths rather than historical details. Okay? So in a nutshell, and you'll find this throughout many of the stories, and again, here you really just have to get into the details, Divrei Hayamim and Melachim will tell the same stories, but Melachim, which is focusing on the historical background of how the Jews got the Churban HaBayit and therefore will discuss complexities, Divrei Hayamim is more of a Musar inspirational work that's meant to get people convinced that they should keep the Torah, which is what Ezra is trying to get people to do, and to be excited about not Malchut Yehuda as much as the area of Yehuda.
Yeah.
And therefore Divrei Hayamim always sort of simplifies things. Bad people are really bad, good people are really good, and bad things happen to bad people, and good things happen to good people. Yes, we'll come to that right at some point. And it tries to always put the good Malchut Yehuda in the best light. Now, the last point I would say is that one of the things that it leaves out, one, is almost all the details of Malchut Yisrael. Right, like Elisha and Eliyahu just don't appear. Right, like those 20 prakim in the middle that were so central Malachim when we cared about the two different Maluchot.
That's fair.
In Divrei Hayamim,
it's hard, it didn't really work.
Well, also, because in Divrei Hayamim, we're not talking about Malachim. Right, we'll sometimes talk about Malchut Yisrael, but the focus is Malchut Yehuda, because we're coming back to Yehuda, we're not coming back to Yisrael.
Right.
Okay? So that is Divrei Hayamim in a nutshell. I think probably barbecue now.
Sure,
then, I think...